first, if that's all right.
Absolutely. Everybody ready? No gavel here, but...
See, I went on a slideshow.
Here.
That's well done. Thank you. Bring your own gavel. Really impressive. Let's call the meeting to order. We're here in the Capitol for the state debt capacity report. Turn it over to Laura Lockwood and call for our presentation. Please.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Did you want to have everybody introduce themselves? Should we
skip
through that?
Good talk. We can. Let's go. We don't have that many people in the room, so let's go around the room and introduce ourselves. Lee, do you want to start?
Lee, Oregon State Treasurer, debt analyst.
Laura Lockwood McCall, Director of our Debt Management Division.
So I'm George Naughton, the Chief Financial Officer in place of Katie Kobler today.
Nancy Nathanson, State Representative.
Tobias Reed, State Treasurer.
Betsy Johnson, Senate District 16.
Tim Dewey, University of Oregon.
Mm-hmm. James? Oh, sorry. You go the other direction. Either way, it's fine. Go ahead, James.
James
Dinks,
a Communications
Treasurer.
Dean Gamers, Finance, and Media. I'm the Invitable.
All right.
Well, thank you. As Tim said, this is a little derivative report in that Tim's been a public member for several years. We follow the same format each year, but we do have a new board member, so with your slight indulgence, I will go through the slides fairly quickly. I'd like to get to some of our emerging debt issues, and also Alice is going to give us a presentation on DAS's program to review the facilities throughout state government and in terms of monitoring for both deferred maintenance and capital improvement, which was something the committee asked for last time. So if I go too fast, The purpose of the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission under state law, 286A, 255, is to provide the legislature and the governor a mechanism to try and evaluate appropriate level of debt issuance that the legislature and the governor should approve per biennium. We try and measure and monitor where the state's debt position is at. We provide information to help formulate the best use of long-term bonding and other capital expenditures. And we've sort of added over the last few years, highlight emerging debt policy issues of concern, which are the last few pages in my presentation. So with that, we have for many years used four big categories when we look at our state's long-term debt. General obligation bonds, which require carve-outs of the Constitution, because our Constitution says you can't borrow more than $50,000 without a carve-out. So we're very conservative in that regard. So you have heard of all the different articles, 11J, P, Q, and so those are all voter-approved carve-outs that allow us to do bonding, and they each have their own separate debt limit. We put very high debt limits on those, and so the debt capacity report is more realistic in terms of how much we really ought to issue. But the debt limits are based on real market value because long ago there was a statewide property tax, and so the real market value mattered because you had to calculate what was the value of property in case you didn't have a resource you could turn to a property tax. More recently, we've sort of eliminated any even mention of property taxes in our carve-outs of different constitutional amendments. But that old debt limit based on RMV lives on, just sort of a historical artifact. We have both general fund supported and non-general fund supported. We call the non-general fund one self-supporting. And for the most part, each of those programs has loan revenues or other streams of income that pretty much take care of themselves. And legislature keeps an eye on it, but it's not quite at the same level unless there's problems. We talked about Department of Energy, some of their loans being either in default or in delinquency, and so that program will need some general fund assistance. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Direct revenue bonds are just that. We have specific revenue streams dedicated. It's not a full faith and credit. And examples include ODOT's revenue bonds for its highway user program, lottery revenue bonds, bond bank, which has underlying loans from local governments for water and sewer projects. Appropriation credits is something we're using less of than we used to. It doesn't involve a carve-out constitutionally, but basically the state is saying we pledge to annually appropriate. Those were used extensively in the past before Article 11Q came into existence because it wasn't very easy to get voters to say, yes, let's finance jails and mental health facilities and things that perhaps are necessary under state government. But back in 2010-11, we had voter approval for Q, Article 11Q, which basically let us refinance most of our COPs into general obligation bonds. We were able to prove to voters we could save money, and we've refinanced a lot of those bonds and saved over $92 million in interest costs since we passed that constitutional amendment. And lastly, we have conduit revenue bonds, where we're really just providing the federal and state tax exemption to private parties under federal tax law. We do it for affordable housing, we do conduit revenue for nonprofits, and we do it as well for industrial development bonds. But the state is not on the hook.
The decision whether or not for profit it has sufficient fiscal strength and integrity to participate in this program.
For the Oregon Facilities Authority, the ultimate proof of the pudding is that if we want to do a public offering, we require two credit ratings of investment grade. So the rating agencies are ultimate sort of reviewer in the public realm.
You've answered my question. I'm perfectly happy with
okay.
it.
Okay. But there are private placements for lower credits, and we do that directly with banks and with high net worth individuals at times. We're pretty conservative, and we're often asked to lower our standards, and we haven't to date.
Right answer.
As Tim has said, you know, we're sort of in, this is the same old, same old, but what the positive part of the same old is you can see that over the many years that we've had the debt capacity model, you can see that our debt, all things being equal, has stayed relatively constant. These are the categories they just mentioned. The pension obligation bonds are in the GO mode, so the two blue together make up all the GO debt. And you can see it's really grown over the decade, but where it's grown is because we've reduced the amount of appropriation credits we have. And then the revenue bonds are in the bottom. So we're in a position where we're issuing new bonds every biennium through the legislative process. We're paying off old debt, and we're somewhat in a, I would call it a steady state. And that has created a great deal of stability in our balance sheet compared to if I were to go back another 10 years, because 20 years ago we had very little debt. And then the 2001-2003 cataclysm happened. The state started having to sell deficit bonds just to survive through the 2003 budget cycle. We had $2 billion in general obligation, pension obligation debt. So it looks great now, but you have to recognize that it wasn't always necessarily that way. And some of the later charts that I think you've asked about Moody's Median, well, you'll sort of see that. This just shows you our general obligation debt and it and how it's grown in the categories of debt. I think the largest area of growth has really been for higher education. We've really embarked on dealing with a lot of the capital needs of the university system through 11F and 11G. And so you can kind of see that's grown. And then you can see the Q's growing, but that's because we're taking out all the COPs and we're doing all of our new state projects and some grant programs for locals through the Q program.
For the record, I'd like you to clarify, because in many other kinds of legislative meetings, when we say higher ed, we mean both universities and community colleges.
Well, and you're right. And 11G can be sold for both the universities, but there's also the ability to do it for community colleges. And definitely the community college program has grown, but it's $100 million, $125 million. So the public universities, particularly the larger, have used the bulk of our mm-hmm. GO bonding, mm-hmm. if that helps.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I should also mention the 11G program, which the state's general fund pays the debt service on, is a 50-50 match. And so one of the things that keeps community colleges necessarily from being bigger than they might be is they have to get voter approval at the local mm-hmm. level before we can sell. So we often have seen the legislature authorize a lot of 11Gs for community colleges, but unless the voters agree to pay for their half of it, it's authorized but unissued.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Laura, with the seemingly unending need of the higher education system, what is the governor on making sure they don't suck up all the capacity?
I'm going to let George answer, since I don't work in the governor's office.
So what the governor's actually done this time is...
Well, I was asking as in governor, as in throttling back.
Oh.
I wasn't asking...
Oh, that kind of governor.
Brown. I was saying, what keeps them from absorbing all of the capacity to the exclusion of other...
And we should both answer that question.
Yeah.
You know, several years ago, we had an executive order that previous governor, Kitzhaber, had laid out a framework, which was no more than 25% over here and 25% for locals. That doesn't exist quite any longer. The debt capacity model itself is the first governor, because it says there's a certain amount that we should just do in general that are general fund. The second one is, now that the universities can sell their own revenue bonds, this is something that both Oregon State and U of O have taken great advantage, and that means that they're using their own revenue streams to pay for the things that they think are the highest and most important priorities. So that helps, because there's several hundred million now that hasn't gone on the state's book. But I think the third thing is that there are so many other capital needs that people like Alice, George, and Jean are gathering information for the legislature, so that you can see the complete menu of all the different kinds of projects we need. The Infrastructure Finance Authority does sort of a similar job for what local government needs are in the realms of water, sewer, port improvements. And so, you know, I'll leave it to George, because you get all the capital requests. But I think that the more we can share all the different things, then it helps the legislature balance the highest priorities.
So ultimately, that is the answer.
That's the answer.
You,
legislature.
The
right. And maybe I'm just using this forum to put down a couple of markers. I personally am very unenthusiastic about the hemorrhaging of additional bonding capacity when we're not taking care of what we've got now. And it just annoys the hell out of me to build stuff and don't take care of it, and when it falls down, come to the legislature and say, buy us a new one.
Yeah,
I have a few things to say about that, too. I'll wait till after the report. And I don't want to knock us off the schedule, but at some point, I'd like to have a few minutes to talk about, you mentioned UO and OSU are taking advantage of that.
The revenue bond.
The revenue bond. The others aren't. So if not, why not, and what's the inducement to?
I'm going to guess, and I think the answer is that UO and OSU have revenue sources that they can count on to finance those bonds, and the other ones can't count on their revenue sources, their student credit hours, for example, or tuition dollars to support the same kind of revenue capacity. I think that's where the answer would lie.
It's part of the answer. U of O has a credit rating that's in the AA category.
Sure.
And I think AA, and we're AA plus, and I think OSU maybe AA minus or maybe A plus. The other schools' credit ratings, if they were to try and go public, PSU has done some stuff. They paid a much higher interest cost, and so think of the state as being
and Southern and Western and Eastern. And
that would be extraordinarily.
Probably
that would be a very tricky. That would be a very tricky wicket for them. They would prefer to do an 11F with us because they get our credit rating,
mm-hmm.
and then we have their revenue stream. So, for example, SOU had an athletic facility,
mm-hmm.
and it's just financially a lot better for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have a sort of worked out our relationships, if you will, since
great.
The time. And as long as they can pay the bills and, heck, make sure that the revenue streams that they're, they're pledging when they say they can do it
mm-hmm.
are doable, then I'm okay, and you know, that's part of Gene and my job is to make sure it's okay.
And change over time as the conditions of the various universities improve. Maybe they do that, but
I'm
make the decision.
Can I
have yeah, sure.
Yeah.
One of the things we do to try to limit the drag on capacity is that from the university's perspective, the 11 Q bonds are sort of their favorite because it's 100% grant, state pays the debt service, they don't owe anything, versus the 11 G, you know, they have to pony up their 50%. NAP versus the 11F is a complete loan to them, and they have to pay the debt service and repay that loan. And so we try to change up the mix of funding that they request. If they request a lot of Qs, very little Ds, very little Fs, we try to do some shifting so if we can get the project they want done funded if it's a good project, but we're not giving away the farm, so to speak. We're sort of increasing the Gs to give them a chance to contribute more and reduce the drag on the general fund capacity.
And who's the we that makes that adjudication?
The CFO's office, as part of the budget process, we analyze all of the requests and look at their funding mix and make recommendations for changes to the funding mix
But that's phase one, but phase two is it goes to capital construction.
Exactly.
And ultimately, Amanda and the people in the Ways and Means may have a lot to say about it as well.
Yeah, we're the ones who approve it as an F or a G or a Q, and if we don't like the mix, we can say we want to change in the mix.
Yeah.
So, Senator, if I could also say, it's not just the universities, though. So the pressure on all this limited resource of $1.1 billion, as we've added in the K-12 matching program for schools, as we've done more on seismic rehabilitation, we're pushing more and more money into the education sector. I think if you add up the higher education, what we're doing with the matching program and the farming program, I mean the school matching and the seismic programs, we're well over 25% of our bonding capacity going to education.
That was my concern.
So the piece of this, the real piece of it, is how do you balance all of these? When Governor Kitzhaber came up with the 25%, it really was under the old paradigm that we were primarily focused on higher education, meaning universities and community colleges. I think as we've gotten more and more into the K-12 world, which is very important, don't get me wrong, it is absolutely putting pressure on how much we can provide for the rest of the system. So that ultimately is what you and Amanda have to balance inside the legislative process. Governor takes first stab, but ultimately you guys decide.
Rolling along. Revenues, again, you see this, I won't say it's exactly steady state, but over time, different ODOT financings have been authorized, OTA 1, 2, and 3, JTA, and then we have the next one that will be coming in a few years. But we're paying off ODOT debt roughly at the same speed that we're taking on ODOT debt. And you can see the lottery bonds have stayed constant because we have a very good formula for lottery bond capacity. And single family and multifamily have shrunk, but I would argue that they're on the mend and that they will be growing quite a bit in the coming years. And we have this tiny little bit for the bond bank, and we've just restarted the program, and hopefully there'll be more to come. Am I going
wrong? Is there a statement anywhere in the materials about the erosion of the original purpose of lottery bonds?
I haven't made that.
Well, I'll make a quick observation. It used to be it's 100% for economic development. It's, what, a little under 25% now for economic development.
The methodology of the report is pretty well listed, but our goal has been 5% general fund revenues as a percentage of general fund debt service. We've had that for a very long time. As I mentioned the other day to you, Representative, it's not it's magic number. Some states have 4%, some have 7%. But probably the largest group of states, the average has been 5. What's nice about using revenues rather than operations is that we have a long-term revenue forecast that comes out from OEA every quarter, and it's in one of those deep appendices that not too many other people read, but I read them. And so it's been a good way for us to continue to recalibrate the model using that forecast. With lottery, we have an indenture that says you have to have 4 times coverage, which is equivalent to no more than 25% of your lottery revenues. We could go lower. We could sell more lottery bonds, but we've chosen not to because we need lottery revenue streams for operations in a variety of areas. And then we'll talk a little bit about some comparisons nationally. General fund, these are the types of bonds that are general fund supported. Several years ago, we started breaking out percentage-wise because really important with pensions, for example. We did $2 billion in general obligation bonds for pensions, of which the general fund only really pays the debt service on about a third. And so that really shrunk the amount of general fund supported. There's ODOT, there's universities, a lot of other non-general fund agencies that also contribute to that. So that's probably the biggest single switch in numbers. And then we just sort of refined and refined and refined all the other programs.
So those total numbers are the total of that category, not...
Right, it's the total of all of it. So out of all of the $10 billion plus in debt and the $6 billion, which is GO bonds, only $3.4 billion is really general fund supported, which is what we focus on for the model. What we've done is we simplify things, and we don't really try and figure out the nuance of what Gene and I will ultimately sell between now and here. We say, it's in the bond bill, we're just assuming it'll be sold, so that way you can do your carry forwards and adjustments later. And this is just a list of all of the bonds that have been authorized by the legislature that we haven't quite sold yet. Gene and I are going to be extremely busy, and so will the treasurer in the next few months, pushing out $1 billion of just GO, general fund, plus the lottery debt. We use the long-term revenue forecast we just published. We've been using the same interest rate for a few years. We've been using the long-term rate of 4.5%. I used to try every year and guesstimate, and I would ask Tim what he thought the long-term rates were and then add 50 basis points. So whatever I did was wrong. Whichever direction I picked, I was always wrong.
The forecast interest rate.
Short-term interest rates have definitely gone up a bit in the past year. Short-term rates have also gone up, the long-term, but they still haven't gone up to the 4.5. And so my plan is if we hit that 4.5% in the long-term, then I'll bump it up to 5. But for now, I think we're fine still using that 4.5% rate.
Can you go back to 9 for just a moment?
Sure.
87% of total...
So some of those Q bonds are self-supporting. So Gene's office will tell me. You know, certain state agencies, even though they're Q bonds, have their own revenue streams that are non-general fund. So we update this every year basically just to see kind of
that's what I was trying to get. 87% of the Qs that are general fund supported. It's a little it was confusing to me when I read that. What do those percentages refer to? Mm-hmm. But it's of that category.
And I would note that a little over a third, almost 40% of the alternate energy, the 11J bonds, are currently general fund. Years ago, the legislature authorized a bunch of deferred maintenance at universities, but we didn't use the normal Gs or whatever. We'd use the Js. And so the general fund kicks in $5 million a year towards that debt service. So every year we're adjusting, we're figuring it out. But for the first time, and we'll talk about it a little later, they're also going to need a general fund subsidy just to cover the balance of their loan portfolio. It's not as bad as I used to think it was, but they are going to be asking for about a little over $4 million this biennium coming up. So that's how you get to the 39% number. This chart, which is in the book, shows you both two different approaches to look at debt capacity. In both cases, when we do the revenue forecast, we say, what's getting paid off? How much can we afford to do a new debt service at that 4.5% rate for 20 years and stay within the 5% target? First, it just shows you if we just sort of say 5% every year, and you can see it's $4.59 billion. But the legislature and the SDPAC have been a little more cautious. Rather than issue a whole lot in 1 year and then have to kind of not issue much in the following year, we've used an averaging approach where we take the full amount over a long period of time and then we kind of divide, in this case, by 4 biennia. And what that does is it spreads capacity out and it makes it easier for us to make mid-course adjustments if we're wrong. It also, I think, allows long-term capital planners to feel more confident that there's roughly going to be about the same amount of capacity per biennium. And it sort of forces a prioritization process that might not be quite as robust if we said, we can do $1.3 billion or $1.4 billion in one biennium and then have to cut back the following biennium.
I think that's really helpful, Laura. And it also, both of you, Senator and Representative, know this, but it's worth stating, too, that there's, as you already said, it's not magic of 574. So if you find that project that you really feel like you got to do and it's 574 point something, that's not
exactly
the end of the world either.
So this just shows you the average, using that averaging approach, our report says that we have approximately $1.15 billion available in each of the next 4 biennia. Several years ago, Jack Kenney suggested we start using sensitivity analysis, person who's in Gene's job. So if revenues start declining in the general fund, you can kind of see how much that cuts what we should be doing per biennium. Conversely, if revenues bump up, how much extra? And you'll see that has a bigger impact on the forecast in terms of the model than really interest rates. On the margins, interest rates matter, but truthfully, it's how much revenue do we have coming in. And so that's, we tend to focus more on that as being the most important thing.
Have you ever done a 10% decline in the forecast and a 1% lower interest rate?
Yeah.
Because
that seems like
that.
That seems like your most likely combination of outcomes, or a 10% increase plus 1% higher.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be sort of with
that would be the worst of the worst cases, wouldn't it?
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's it cuts you in between those numbers is what it would do, but, you know, it's an interesting question.
You know, we've also used more taxable, less tax-exempt, but it's a variation on the theme of interest rates.
Right.
So we sort of decided to simplify that.
It makes sense.
So we're going to talk about lottery, and I think this screen will be exactly what Representative Nathan was saying, which is that I wasn't here, obviously, when lottery was created and what it was supposed to be for, but it has really expanded to be for everything that the state needs done because it's the most flexible stream of revenue we have, and the rules other than taxable, tax exempt, it can be used for education, environment, or economic development under the Constitution. So
and a lot of things can fit under those.
Most things can fit under those.
Beat to fit, paint to match.
Yeah, that's right.
It's both a blessing and a curse, I think, because it's been used really successfully. For example, when we did the light rail project for the light rail to Milwaukee, it was it was $250 million, right, when we had video lottery terminals starting. Mm-hmm. But it brought in a lot of federal revenue we might not have otherwise seen. So, again, it's a bit in the eye of the beholder. But, again, I would argue that every session the legislature, Capital Construction Committee, Ways and Means, gets to set the tone as to what they want to use it for. I know.
That's an phrase of eating your steam corn.
Yes.
Well, and that's why we've never lowered the 4x coverage to a lower thing, which we could have easily done. We have the highest credit rating among – there's only 3 or 4 states that have lottery bonds. We're the highest credit rating. Mm-hmm. And our coverage is actually going over 5x. We're not using more than 20% of it. I'm going to make a pitch to get a rating upgrade because we're so conservative. But having said that, it has been a really important tool. We recapitalized the Special Public Works Fund with that, which makes a huge difference for local governments when they're doing water sewer deals. We've been able to do a lot of fairly low interest rate loans to communities that are well below the median income in the state. I sit as a treasurer's representative on that board, so I know. And I know it's helped the ports. And so it all kind of depends on what the projects are for and making sure Connect Oregon grants have been a huge success. Mm-hmm. It also gets funded through lottery bonds. I guess that's economic development.
And you'll be adding veterans as another bullet point down there.
But we don't do bonding necessarily, do we? I think that's more...
It's just right off the top.
It's off the top. It's pure revenue.
Okay.
And so we have $1.1 billion, and we've had $1.1 billion for a number of years because we keep the debt service fairly short.
Mr. Treasurer, do you ultimately have the authority to maintain that 4x coverage?
I think that would end up being the legislature's decision.
It's actually more than that. It's the indenture itself.
Okay.
Yeah. We're not allowed to – we have to do an additional bonds test. We're not allowed to go below it. Now,
but
we open up a new bond deal.
But in order to do that, would we need legislative approval?
No.
Okay.
Well, what I was looking for was the sort of conservative prophylactic to keep from messing around with this. We have an excellent credit rating because of your conservative approach.
Yeah.
And I just didn't know the level of caprice that could modify that 4x coverage.
Well, I speaking only for myself, I'd be really reluctant to do that for all the reasons we've already articulated, and also because as much as $1 billion is $1 billion, it's not a massive amount when compared to the other tools that are available.
See, how long have you been treasurer and suddenly $1 billion isn't a big deal?
relatively.
But we could open a senior indenture.
Relative, we're 4.6.
For clarification purposes, the 4x coverage applies when you actually sell the debt. So that's when you actually apply the test, correct? So
yes.
What would happen if the lottery funds actually decline in the future?
We would either not be able to sell the bonds, we could say to the legislature.
Couldn't sell the new bonds.
We couldn't sell the new bonds, or we could go back and tell the legislature, do you still really want us to do that? And then we would open up a junior indenture and a lower coverage. I'll give you an example. We did that, OTIA 1 and 2. Then we did OTIA 3. Well, the senior indenture back in those days for highway user was 3x coverage, and we didn't have enough capacity. So we opened up a junior indenture, which had one notch lower rating at 2x coverage, which was still very good, and we still have a AA+ credit rating. But it was how we were able to get OTIA 3 done.
And that's some sort of rating Oregon as opposed to rating a specific issuance, right?
It was how the entire highway user bonds were rated. And so we legally had to do something. The legislature didn't tell us to do it. We had to do it because they wanted us to sell the bonds for the highway user program, and that was something we had to do to make it work.
Yeah.
But we're not there, hopefully. Now, my only other thing would be, I wouldn't want to go to below 4 unless, let's say, we had a massive earthquake and we needed capacity. So, again, it's like you don't really want to do these things, again, but these are tools in our toolkit, so I can see both sides of an
earthquake. If we have a massive earthquake, there probably is going to be a change in law.
Yes.
Perhaps. But let's say we're in the rebuild mode.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have $221.5 million in lottery bonds that we'll be selling in late March for projects that were authorized by the 17 and 18 legislatures. We use the same interest rate. We use the same 20-year amortization. And what I just did want to share with you is that lottery revenues, this long-term forecast, I know you know a lot about the short-term, but we've been keeping track of the long-term forecast, and you can see it's gotten considerably better. And this is something Josh Learning has come and talked to this commission about in the past, which was, I think he came back when it was the yellow line, which was in 17. Because we were doing the video lottery replacement, revenues were flat, and it was also the tail end of the recession. People weren't spending as much on lottery. And so we did scale back the amount of lottery bonds we were issuing because this long-term forecast scaled quite a bit back. But you can see that the forecasts are going up, and he's sort of restored, because I think the casino north of the border hasn't proven to be as big a competition to our lottery. Our population is growing. So the green line at the top represents what we use in this forecast. And why it's significant is that a year ago at this time, we thought we had in the neighborhood of $220 million, as you saw. But our forecast, because of all those years out, is now looking like we have about $305 million per biennium that we can now do. Doesn't mean we have to do it, but because long-term forecasts have modified, that's what our long-term forecast is. Again, it's the same thing as Tim mentioned in terms of interest rates and declines at the same time. My guess is if both of those things happened, it would have a pretty good whomping impact on capacity. But that's where we're at.
Technical term.
Whomping.
Whomping.
Technical term.
It would be a whomping.
Yes.
It would be a double doozy. I think that if revenues declined in lottery, that would be telling us that we were in a recession. And if we're in a recession, then I think interest rates might be lower, not higher. So who knows? Hard to say. So that's the numbers. I'm done with the capacity portion of the report. Do you have any questions? So net tax reported debt is a term that the rating agencies use, because every state has a different constitution and way that they book all their funds. And so they're trying to compare all of us to each other. And so their concept is they don't care, in our case, that ODOT sits in a special constitutional fund. If we have ODOT debt, then we've chosen to do some taxes as part of that. So what we do to compare ourselves to others is we throw in all the pension bonds, the balance of the Qs and COPs that were not general fund, our lottery bonds, and then our highway bonds. And so you can see when we look at it that way, the net tax reported debt of the state. And we have just ratios about what that is per capita and as a percentage of personal income. Not every state chose to do pension obligation bonds when we did. That doesn't mean they don't have unfunded liabilities. Many years ago, I don't think the rating agencies had really focused on that. It turns out that there's more unfunded liability among states in the United States than there is debt outstanding.
Oh, God, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. So now they really spend a lot of time talking about that. And why that matters is, okay, this is the Moody's median, and this used to be the standard. We would just look at public debt of the 50 states, and we would say, okay, the Moody's median is, what is the median debt as this percentage, and they do personal income, and they do one per capita. I just chose personal income. And what I tried to do with this chart over the years is show you the components, so the big stuff. So you can see, starting from the bottom, we have our other net tax-supported debt. We've got our lottery in that light blue. The COPs have been declining. The lighter thing is the Q bonds have been replacing it. If it was just that, we would be below the median. But you got to add in the fact that we have a lot of ODOT debt, and we're a state that's growing. We're also a big geographic area, so our ODOT debt may be bigger than a lot of states in terms of how we have chosen to finance highways. And then on top of that...
You're talking about road miles.
Yes.
Compared.
Okay. Yeah, sure. And then on top of all of that are the pension bonds. So you can see that our ratios, if you just looked at the public debt of us versus everybody else, we're near the top. We're like in the top tier. I think we're usually either 11th, 12th, or 13th highest. And, you know, that would be very concerning, which is, oh, we have very high debt. What folks are doing in more recent years, particularly Standard & Poor's, is saying, let's look at all the debt, everything on the balance sheet, not just the publicly offered debt. Let's take a look also at their net pension liability debt, which is now reported in all 50 states' financial reports. And because of GASB, all of the states have to calculate it in the same way. Historically, it was just an actuary, and every state had little tricks, techniques, and methodologies, so you couldn't really compare apples to apples. So the past years, we've been able to do that. And so this is a little bit of a lag. It takes a couple of years to get those reports out before you can see the numbers. So this is the most recent one. It's for fiscal year 2017. And what you see is Oregon's actually 12th still, but now we're the 12th lowest, or excuse me, the 12th best when it comes to funding of pension ratio, of pension funds. We were at 83% for that year. And you can see when they take into account public debt, pension liability, and, by the way, OPEB, which is the other personal
post-employment
benefits, which is like health care, our numbers are well below the 50 state averages. And that's, we have fairly small amount of OPEB liability. We have been addressing our UAL, maybe not perfectly, but we have sold pension obligation bonds. And so, as I said, I'm going to show you the next chart that really, really shows you kind of, again, it's starting so small on the page, but the OPEB of the states to the far right is enormous. Places like New Jersey, Connecticut, Illinois, those are states that have a lot of pension liability debt, which is the yellow on the bottom, and a lot of OPEB debt. So where we end up is kind of around, I don't know, 14, 15, 16, when you combine all three together relative to other states.
Add in the borrowing costs each of these states, right?
That's an amazing thing, which is New Jersey and Illinois have actually borrowed for annual pension costs over the years.
Yeah.
So think about that on top of...
Which is amazing.
That's the real eating of your seed corn.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that we don't have to work on our PERS and we need to keep on, you know, solving our problems, but because all 50 states have those problems. But I just wanted to kind of... I feel like this chart is better than anything else because it's a more accurate perspective of where we really stand. Okay, so...
And among the states, we're more aggressive at actually dealing with our issues. That's the key. We're much more transparent about it, so we have more conversations about employer rates and changing pensions and things like that. You don't see those conversations.
And we don't play games with those contributions, which is reflected in the rating.
There's a... Paul Volcker has a thing called the Volcker Institute, and I'm sure you've seen that report, but they do a report card. We got an A in terms of pension, addressing pension. We still need to work on, I think they said long-term budget forecasting, we got a B, but we did okay. All things, or maybe a C, I don't remember exactly, but.
Sure, stuff was older.
Yeah. Well, I just happened to look at it the other day, so. Now, these are the non-tax supported programs. These are the ones I've mentioned earlier. Should each have a stream of loans or some other method that pays the debt. And so, again, we don't necessarily hold them to the same standard. It's important that they do pay their own bills. And when there is a problem, we try and use this as the early, this commission as the early alert system, which we tried to do years ago as we knew the alternative energy bond program was facing some problems. So that's the range in there. I wanted to give you a brief update. Again, I got a spreadsheet a few months ago from the folks at Department of Energy. About a year and a half, maybe almost 2 years ago, we did a refunding and a restructuring of some of their bond portfolio and saved them several million dollars. They've also, from what I've been told, have been much more aggressive than in the past in terms of pursuing people with delinquent loans, doing restructuring. So the spreadsheet that I looked at and the cash flows I looked at did suggest that they would need a cash infusion from the general fund this biennium. But but not too much after that. Maybe just a few million dollars over the next, I don't know, 7 to 10 years after that. So to me, that's huge progress, because several years ago I came to this commission and it was over 20 million. I don't know. Your question was what other specific things they can do. But I do know they tighten their standards. They're not issuing a lot of new loans because they don't have enough resource.
Good.
Yeah, I think part of the problem is just some of the past loans are just sitting there. And so you we're docked, right? I mean, that's the...
I don't have intimate knowledge.
They're not issuing a lot of
loans. We haven't loaned the money to loan to other people.
Right.
Yeah, so, my question had been, right now we're reacting to things that happened, but what... Is there something else we should be doing to reduce the risk of additional delinquencies?
In this program.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think making less loans is what they've done.
That
is the key there.
Okay. And that's the most important thing. Is there
and being
else?
Able to pursue the workouts with the delinquents. Like,
and it appears that they've been able to pursue it. So keep on keeping on, because
yeah,
it definitely is better than it was several years ago. But I don't have any more intimate knowledge than that.
No, I mean, the legislature specifically did not give them any bond authority last session. They want to have any more bonds to take from loans. So they could figure out what to
The thing about
the conversation in the governor's budget was similar to that. The governor's budget includes $4.3 million set aside to pay this down. Another alternative is you actually allow them to start issuing more debt to create a revenue stream. We've been, like Senator Johnson saying, no, let's just pay our liability and keep moving on with the next.
Probably have to really understand the program a lot more and what it's going to be used to before you start.
Well, and if I could say, it was originally created to help OMSI, and the original bonds were, and the general fund kicked in a little bit of money to help OMSI with the debt service, and they did a great job. They had good reserves when I first came to Oregon, but over time, unfortunately, people started seeing less as helping schools and OMSIs of the world, and started doing more economic development projects. But it was our credit. It was the state's GO guarantee, which, unfortunately, they picked a few projects that didn't pan out, and they were large dollar amounts, and that's really what ate up their reserves and then cascaded the problem.
Those few bad choices. Yeah.
Yes. There was a period where we were using our general obligation bond to chase alternative energy projects. At a time, we thought that would be the great savior of Oregon, and they didn't have tight enough underwriting standards to really understand the risks we were taking.
We weren't a primary creditor either.
No,
so
but when you do a $200 million ethanol project, and even if you give them $18 million and you lose the $18 million in the debt service, that eats up all your reserves.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but there's a cautionary tale here, too. If the state is awash in money from cap and trade, this is bonded indebtedness. I worry about picking faulty projects if we're awash in cash and it's just, let's go buy stuff. And the level of due diligence was shockingly bad in this program, and I think has the potential to be shockingly bad again, only we won't be issuing debt.
Hopefully don't do that.
Yeah. The economics also changed, too. At the time that these were happening, we were looking at oil prices that were significantly higher.
Sure.
When we dropped down to $44 a barrel, these things don't pencil out anymore. And so that's partly why these things dropped the way they
were. Arguably, that was partially due diligence, though, too.
That would be my
assumption.
Absolutely.
A lot of oil in that world, as it turns out.
Well, you know, it's very tempting to help, you know, do economic development. But sometimes maybe that's where the value of the lottery bond is, because it's one and done.
Yeah.
When you make a loan that you've guaranteed, and so you're using your credit quality, I think sometimes you want to do it as more of a grant to a project and limit your, you know, cut your losses.
Cut your losses straight up, yeah.
What's the urgency of the 4.4?
Well, they simply won't be able to cover their debt service with cash flow this coming biennium. But relatively,
a hell of an incentive to work on them workouts.
I think they've done that, because I thought there was going to be $20 million between now and 2034, a couple of years ago, looking back at old reports and old cash flows. So to see the cash flows reduced to just a few more, I mean, it's still not good, but relatively speaking, I'm glad that we did the refunding and restructuring, and they've been working on things.
Ultimately, aren't we liable for this anyway?
Yes, sir.
4.4. Yeah, which also speaks, by the way, to Oregon.
It's the state of Oregon. That's what it means when it's a full faith and credit pledge.
It also speaks to the good work that the Treasurer's Office has done, you've done, of identifying these things before they become bigger problems so the legislature can
And that's why I focus on our commission has sort of grown into the early warning sign. I didn't get a chance to do this as part of last year's presentation, but I have done some early warning signs in earlier commission meetings where we talk about the school bond guarantees we've done. The school bond guarantee program was created in the 90s in the treasurer's office, and it was a constitutional amendment. And what it does is it allows us, if school districts qualify, and by that it's K-12 and community colleges, if it's voter-approved GO debt, we will guarantee to investors that come hell or high water, if for some reason the community can't pay their debt service, we'll make the payment, and then we'll turn around, and we'll take state aid, or we'll work out a deal with the community later to make sure the debt service gets paid. And it started out as a great idea, but, you know, back when it started, the credit rating of the state wasn't fantastic, and most school districts were better off buying bond insurance, which is the same thing, because it gave them the AAA rating. Well, bond insurance went away in about 2007, 2008. So since that time, we have really been the only real credit improver available to school districts. Not every school district needs it. Portland Public Schools doesn't need it, but a lot of other school districts, their taxpayers get the benefit of a lower interest rate because of our guarantee. We've worked to tighten up some of the criteria around the program, but it's still just grown by leaps and bounds. And what this chart shows you, and we have never made an actual payment, ever, 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 because really, unless the property assessor and the tax collectors screw up the millage rate, why would we? But there's always a chance that there's a major earthquake or something that would change the overall property value, and I could see us needing to step in. But having said that, programs just continue to grow and grow and grow.
So it grows and grows and grows, and there's nothing to throttle it? There's no caps or...
I haven't yet found anyone who really wanted to say no, because we want to help school districts and taxpayers. The thing is that we've tried to enhance the program so that when school districts sign up, they know that they're ultimately responsible. We're really more of a lockbox. But in a worst-case scenario, under our Constitution, if we had to do a workout, we could sell GO bonds and spread that repayment out over time if we had to.
Well, in a worst, wouldn't the first step, though, we just strip them of state aid?
Let's be very realistic.
Oh, okay,
We could do a loan from the Common School Fund. We could remember borrowing money out of the State Children's Fund. We would figure out a solution. But as the underwriters I've worked with over the years said, look, realistically, let's just say it was a millage strip. The next property tax cycle, we would get the money. It would be a one payment. Mm-hmm. If it was a major earthquake, it could be several years the state might be on the hook for. But again, probably not every school district, every part of the state would have an ultimate problem.
What are they using these funds for?
This just, it's not, if they're, they've got voter approval to build a new grade school or a new high school. And so, again, it's being used by all the school districts whose credit rating would benefit from our AA+.
But they have. It's voter-approved finances.
All of it.
All voter-approved money.
All of it.
So that creates some backstop.
And you can see,
you'd have to be really, have to be hit with a significant economic downturn.
For a fairly long time.
For a fairly long time, and actually fairly unlikely because it's hooked to property taxes, and where our property tax state works typically makes you less vulnerable to the downside.
And even in Clatsop County or in Tillamook County, probably not the entire county would go down. And so the way the property taxes get allocated, as Carol Samuels bankers told me, you know, there would be a way to make it work. But it's just something that I want the commission to be aware of. We report about it each year. And this just shows you what we owe, both principal, or not what we owe, but the contingent liability, and that's all it is, in the coming year. In a year.
Just to fill in my lack of experience, bond insurance went away, but say one more sentence about that.
Okay, so in 2007-08, the entire capital markets system as we know it, United States and world, melted away. Bond insurance were these different companies who basically did the same thing, which was they told an investor, I'll step in and pay.
Yeah.
It was all what did they do with the premiums that they collected from everybody? Oh, well, they bought those same asset-backed securities everybody else bought. So their balance sheets blew up, and they disappeared. They went from AAA one day to
non-existent.
They all went bankrupt.
And no one stepped in to fill that.
Fortunately, AIG,
really?
Which wasn't exactly a bond insurer, but we had placed $200 million for U of O basketball arena with them as an investment. We got our money back. But thank gosh, I wouldn't be here today probably talking to you. But so they got bailed out. But no, they didn't get bailed out. So yeah, investors basically bought something at an interest rate that where the risk, and it was really the rating agencies. And the other thing was rating agencies back in that era had ratings for municipalities, state and local, on a completely different scale than they did for the private sector. And so Treasurer Randall Edwards fought hard, among other treasurers, and got the rating agencies to have one scale, mm-hmm. not two. And so our ratings went up. And so the bond insurance thing was kind of a joke, because when we sold pension bonds, got a corporate rating, we were a AAA. And that's why Randall got so mad, because he realized what a scam it was that the rating agencies were pulling on people for those bond insurance companies all those years.
Oh, thank you.
Sorry, it's more than one sentence.
Wow,
but
that was fun.
Okay, to keep rolling, because this is where I want to come to. The state also has a program to guarantee pension obligation bonds sold by local schools and community colleges. And it's called a fund diversion agreement. Department of Education administers the program and has since 2001. Between 2002 and 2007, there's 9 separate pool deals. There have been at least one deal that's happened in the last fiscal year. Over $3 billion was issued. Now, unlike the contingent liability that I just mentioned for school bond guarantee, this is real state aid every year that's going out of the budget the legislature appropriates and is basically sent directly to the trustee to pay debt service for their pension obligation bonds. They just mentioned 4 school districts recently, just subsequent to the end of the fiscal year, sold a pension obligation bond. I think there are a lot more school districts are going to consider doing it. I know that we've talked about it last biennium in the legislature. Is it a good idea? Is it a bad idea? When you are facing down big increases in the amount of pension that you're going to have to budget, funding your liability, you can borrow at 4.5% to 5% instead of whatever the amortization rate PERS would have. It's going to save you some money in the short run. But it's completely dependent upon you earning a certain rate of return every year for the life of the bonds. And for those who just sold those pension bonds, I don't know if they put the money in the bank before the stock market collapsed or after it. So if it was afterwards, maybe, right now it would be a better time to do it, but I can see this being a temptation for a lot of school districts in the coming years.
Who, when they get the money, where do they invest? I mean, who's their investment?
They give it to PERS, and they give it to the treasurers.
Okay, they do.
It goes in a side account.
Into a side account. Okay.
But they are not necessarily obligated to have their own independent advisor as they consider whether or not to do that.
Okay.
And that might be something the legislature can consider requiring.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you said, I mean, basically this is a kick the can down the road program, right? Because the way it works is you borrow at 4.5%, you book it at your assumed 7% return.
You'll never know until the life.
You're hoping to beat the cost of capital.
You won't know until the end of the program whether it was a good idea.
You won't know until it's the end of the program. Because instantly once you put in your program, it's assumed to earn 7.5% or whatever, 6.5%, whatever.
But you don't know.
And that drops your liability, so then you can reduce
your
payments.
If you can earn a good amount the first 2 or 3 years, it's kind of like an endowment. You're not pulling out as much as you think you need to pull out. It's a very high odds that you'll do great for the life of it.
Right.
But if you have a bad year the first year you do it, and there were some districts
really
that did it in 2007, you can't dig yourself out of the hole that you created in the beginning. And so they've been running Monte Carlo simulations about different outcomes, and I've seen a lot of them, but it's all based on assumptions about the future looking like the past.
Yeah, you really actually should. I mean, if I was doing this, I would encourage them to do this after a market crash.
Well, like right, I said,
when you should do it.
Doing it now might have been better
doing
than
it
we
now
did it
would
in the
have
fall.
Been better than a year ago.
Yeah.
Or wait till the next recession, the time when you don't think you can do these things, that's when you do them. That will give you the most likely outcome.
The timing is so tricky, though, and given the time it takes school administrators and school boards to discuss issues. You know, you tee up a discussion,
right.
You have a report, someone makes a recommendation, maybe the school board goes on vacation for the summer,
right.
You come back, you make a decision. You can't guarantee, it's not nimble like
right.
The private sector. You make a decision
right.
Or you hold back.
You almost have to have some kind of, I think you're right, you have to have some kind of like pre-planned thing, right?
Yeah, if this, then that. If you make a decision and say, you may do this under these circumstances with this timing, that's probably not how the instructions are given when school boards make those
it's
decisions.
It's a tough decision because it's a speculative risk, and you know, and so GFOA, which is the National Financial Officers Group, they just say it's speculative. So it may be wise 15 years later, you look back, but it's something that financial officers are awfully cautious about.
Well, I went to an NCSL meeting a couple of years ago, and the actuary who was presenting there was looking directly at legislators and some school board people and said, you're making the wrong decision. You may get lucky and it comes out okay,
yeah.
But it's more like
good
luck
outcome
of the timing.
Is not the same as good decision.
And,
boy, and I'm wondering the degree of sophistication of some of the school boards, whether or not OSBA or anybody is advising the school board. They may, in some local jurisdiction, think this is a panacea and march themselves right off the plank.
Well, at the very bottom of this, several years ago when they first brought this up, we had a bill when Treasurer Wheeler was here to try and at least have Treasury take a look at things. OSBA came out in force and said, don't touch our program. Kick me in the butt and sit me on my way on that hearing. So
Kim's right, though. What we should be doing is stockpiling some money and make a big investment. 2009, for example, would have been a great time to do something like that.
You might not be able to call a market top, but you can pretty be sure after the fact you're at top. I mean, there's a way you can at least game the system a little bit better.
Well, for what it's worth, they do have an incentive fund for schools to match with cash to kick into the site accounts.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm hearing, though, is this is a use of one-time money, too. Many slides ago, you were talking about, we're going to have this additional capacity
because
of lottery, for example.
Yes.
Things happen sometimes, and you recognize you have additional capacity, but that's a one-time snapshot. So how do you use it?
That last question you asked is the operative one that we will all confront. How do you use it? This is hardly the only thing that will come before you.
Yeah.
If done right, this can be a good tool to help. It can.
But and if done wrong, it's a boat anchor.
Yeah.
Well, this is where debt is an extremely powerful tool.
If you can spin it a different way, and there's some value to kicking the can down the road, I think that's actually in some ways often underrated as... we see it on national debt issues a lot where we kind of avoid a near-term crisis and kick the can down the road and actually give us some time to figure out the right solution. So in some of these cases, I don't think it's the worst thing. It's not my optimal choice, though.
So as far as one time, because of the corporate repatriation, that's where the governor and the legislature put a pot of that money for the PERS match to get it into the site accounts without using debt.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that legislation is currently written so you can't use bonds to do your match. You have to use your excess cash.
Yeah.
So that was an attempt to do it. This chart just shows you the combination. The lower color is the real fund diversions that we're doing, and then the blue is the OSBG. So it's a growing part of state aid. So if people do it, just note that more state aid, we're up to 7% of our state aid is actually being used to pay debt service on the bond, on these POBs now. So that's a real number.
I'm interested in the comment you made about OSBA reacting poorly to a suggestion saying, don't mess with what we're doing. But what if the requirement, it's really a transparency issue. What if it were a requirement simply around the issue of you need independent expertise, advising, preparing this report that goes to your school board? It's not saying ultimately usurping their ability to make a bad decision, but it's saying you have to
I think that was
some information.
I suspect they would be okay with that. It's because it's transparent.
The status quo.
Are we taking a note of this?
We are taking note of this. I was just thinking what committee it could be introduced out of.
Revenue.
Maybe.
Only we knew it. Revenue
share.
Yes.
I think you know, they just felt that they didn't really want Treasury going like this or that.
Yeah.
So I think it's keeping it at the local level decision making, but just making sure the general public and everybody, there's a lot of transparency, would be a great suggestion.
So one of those tough questions, right? They want a local level decision, but they want state money.
Yeah.
State support, right?
Yeah.
It's always.
Of course.
Right. So education.
As long as Amanda and Mazen are both sitting right there, what's an appropriate venue for a bill like this to emanate? Revenue, ways and means?
Or education itself? Because that's where it's embedded right now, the program.
I think revenue and ways and means probably.
Because I had to go before the education committee, and that's where was the beginning and the end of my bill.
But those are people who specialize in programs, not
I understand.
Education would be policy.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to get somebody holding the bag for getting this bill drafted, and I'm asking, revenue makes more sense, Mazen?
Let's put stock in revenue.
Okay.
I'll have a little chat with Chris.
Okay, cool.
In the interest of time, I'm going to roll forward. One last thing I want to mention, and this is something I've been discussing with the treasurer. In the bond bill each biennium, sort of probably not a lot of people pay attention to it, but we have an allocation from the federal government for what's called private activity bonds. In 1986, the tax laws were tightened, and there's governmental bonds, which is mostly what we talk about, but those conduits that I mentioned earlier where we do affordable housing, first-time home buyer programs, those types of programs, economic development programs, we've helped finance. Georgia Pacific did a recycling facility on the coast years ago. Those all need an allocation in order to get tax exemption of what's called private activity bonds. I'm the treasurer's representative. Jean is the director of DASA's representative, and we have a public member. The legislature allocates a portion to Oregon Housing, Oregon Business Development, and few other places, and then the balance goes to this committee that Jean and I and a public member are on. And throughout the year, we get requests from different parties for allocations. Not a problem. We have lots of allocation. We've been rolling most of it when we don't use it to Oregon Housing. Well, we're now in a position where we have about to have more requests than we can possibly support and still meet everybody's needs. And the reason is, in part, because there's a huge upturn in the amount of affordable housing we're doing. So usually we have 100, 200 million left over. Well, this year, Oregon Housing Community Services did 125, 130 million in first-time home buyers again. And the reason that that's happening is as interest rates go up, they can earn a full spread between the borrowing costs for their program and then what we can loan the money out, and still very attractive to first-time home buyers. So that program's happening. We've doubled down on the amount of affordable housing we're doing. We're doing zillions of multifamily housing deals to try and meet the need for multifamily housing. And so we're using up that capacity faster. Simultaneously, we changed the Constitution, and now local governments can also sell GO bonds for affordable housing. So Metro just passed a $650 million bond issue, and Portland Housing has a couple hundred million. Why does it matter? Well, there's a thing called a 4% tax credit, and there's a 9% tax credit, which is equity. You can sell these tax credits and get equity investors to come in and leverage the dollars that you have for more affordable housing. For the 4% tax credit program, which is we have an infinite amount of, we only have a limited amount of 9%, you have to sell tax-exempt bonds as a 50% match for those 4% tax credits. So that $652 million that Metro passed, they can get 4% tax credits, they can double the amount of money that they can invest in affordable housing. But you have to have PAB, so every one of those projects is now going to be coming through the door between now and the next few years, as well as Portland Housing, plus our own state housing group is at a much more rapid pace. Simultaneously, we have requests to do resource recovery projects, to do energy projects. We just approved a big project down in Lakeview. Intel's coming and asking for money allocation so they can issue debt and a tax exempt rate for their improvements to their wastewater and their sewage facilities as they're about to embark on a major new increase. So we're about to see this collision of forces. So I'm mostly in this report just said to the legislature, heads up, you need to be thinking about how you want to allocate. The governor's budget doubled the amount of PAB. We have about 440 million.
So that's the only thing that I have asked you before, and you answered very well.
Yeah.
To share with this group, it starts with a calculation from Congress that's $105.
It's $105 per person. And
that's
where
we start with.
Right, that's what we get.
Yeah.
There's a minimum for really small states, but for our state, it's $105 per person, and it's been that $105 forever. So you only get growth in it based on population. Nothing to do with inflation or need or whatever.
That's just what we start with. And then
we get each year. So in the past, the legislature and the governor, they put about $125 million per year, calendar year, into Oregon housing, which was enough, but not so much anymore. 40-ish million for Business Oregon, a few million for a few other things. And then the balance just went to this PAB committee. In the governor's proposed budget for calendar year 20 and 21, she's doubled up the amount that she'd recommend the legislature authorize for Oregon housing, which will simultaneously reduce the amount that goes to this committee. That may be the right answer, but that will put even more pressure on us to decide between local government projects and economic development projects.
Do you feel like you're in a position to do that? I mean, that would be my question, is do you...
What do you mean by in a position?
Well, you're
a choice, right?
You have no choice. I understand that. Would you like the legislature to make that? I mean,
they're the ones who choose.
Yeah, you're asking to make these trade-offs, right? Or do you recommend these trade-offs to legislature?
I think the legislature just needs to think about it.
Oh,
and,
there's two levels of trade-offs, right?
Right.
There's the trade-off between housing and everything else.
Right.
And then in the everything else, it's...
Who's making, that's what I'm asking, who has the final say on that within the everything else?
Historically, the PAB under statute says, here's all the categories we care about, but there's been nobody saying... And between all those categories, we want housing,
okay, that's what
or we want economic development. Obviously, I represent the treasurer. Gene represents the governor through the director of DAS. And then we have a public member.
Right.
And one idea is just to say, well, you know what? We're just going to divide it by four quarters, and we're going to do jump ball every quarter, and whoever comes in with a project that's ready to go wins. Alternatively, we could say we really need housing because economic development has other sources. For 4% tax credits, there's no other game in town. I would like somebody who's a policymaker to tell me what to do.
It sounds like you need a policymaker to be in that group or would be involved somehow.
And the legislature...
Not to make your life harder, but I think it makes it...
I think it would make my life easier.
Yeah,
I think that's really all we can do in this report is say, this is an issue.
Right.
It's in the executive summary. It's an issue. I hope the legislature, as they're doing their deliberations, will consider this. And again, you could touch the PAB statutes, and you can tell us what our highest priorities are or not.
Laura, what does the effect of the audit of Oregon's expenditure of federal money in the housing issue area? For 10 years, housing has gotten a management letter. I mean, I'm using private sector nomenclature, but has been criticized for their failure to manage subgrantees. And now all of a sudden this huge amount of money is asked for in the governor's budget. You're talking about the pressure for housing within this committee. And I'm trying to figure out what effect this bad audit has. It's a decade-long bad audit.
I don't have a point of view. I think that there's a lot of pressure on Oregon housing in general to do more and to be more, and I know they have a request in for a number of new positions, and it will impact my work because we'll just, but I can't really speak to whether their capacity internally is up to the task.
Well, let me be clear. I think Margaret Salazar is a breath of fresh air in what has heretofore been a broken agency, and so I brook no criticism with her. She's inherited a lot of problems. But I don't think we can turn a blind eye to the fact that we have been criticized in an audit for at least a decade for our inability to manage subgrantees. And with money now hemorrhaging into the system, what's our downside liability of trying to push this out and pushing it out into people who are completely incapable of delivering? and one of the community action teams, and in the interest of full disclosure, my husband sits on the board of our community action team, but another one, not his, has just had a very severe fiscal downturn, and there's no malfeasance alleged, but certainly mismanagement. And I'm just sounding the alarm that I think in our zeal to do good, if we abrogate our due diligence, we are going to set ourselves up for some kind of catastrophe, and we are talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. Metro has no experience in building affordable housing, and they now have the power to go out into the market with $652 million worth of voter-approved authority. And it's, to me, it's very concerning.
I don't know much about the Metro plans. I actually have a call in with Margaret tomorrow to find out where their pipeline is, because they want to sub-allocate to different housing authorities and to nonprofits, and they may not even realize that to get the 4% tax credit, they have to come and get a PAB first. So I would share your reservations that this whole thing needs to be well orchestrated together. And you know, I'm just a little tiny at the back end, sort of hinting that there's stuff that's going to need to be done at the front end to make sure that it's done well, and really what the policies that we want to see done in terms of the right projects in the right places.
Well, she's a very capable leader with federal as well as state experience. Yes. She comes from HUD.
Yeah.
And again, if this is being recorded or listened to by others, I make no criticism of Margaret Salazar. But I think she's got a volatile situation here that will be fueled by the political pressure of more housing of all kinds. And if we don't watch our P's and Q's, we could have some real stinkers in here.
Fortunately, you know, for the borrowing, all of the borrowing will be done as conduit, multifamily deals. Again, we sit on every conference call, and again, the borrow, it's all, for the most part, privately placed. There are a few public offerings where we make very clear it's not the state of Oregon's credit, and that's very important.
Laura, just to finish this, when these things go bust, I noticed the Oregon Garden in here that we have financed with lottery bonds.
You're right.
That went bust, and we came in and bailed it out, and we get one of these failed housing projects, and the default is going to be the general fund.
Hopefully, well, you may be right in the political world, but at least from a legal perspective, we're not putting the state on the hook.
Yeah, or you're going to get a black eye for any failed projects regardless.
We are going to be putting, if the governor's budget is approved, as adopted, a fair amount of 11Q GO bonds in as equity kick-ins like we did for the LIFT program. So we are, I think those numbers have grown quite a bit as well. So these will be things for the legislature to review and evaluate whether those are the right choices.
It strikes me that the DOE issues are a comparator, is what you're
bingo,
is that
sure,
in the rush to do good or pursue, you know, well, doing good essentially, that you end up wasting a lot of money.
With a political wind at your back to do good, and we end up with egg all over us.
But, Senator, I also argue that some of this comes down to the management capacity inside the organization. So not just with housing, but with many of our programs. In 2008, with the downturn economy, we gutted lots of our administrative oversight programs, whether it's accountants, internal auditors, which you've heard a lot about, or other things. As we pushed money into new programs, we have not commensurate increase in staffing to actually do the oversight.
And I would push back on you, all budgets are about priorities, and DAS has made certain decisions that some things are more important than auditors. So this notion that we're going to blame the legislature, the parsimonious legislature, for the failed oversight, I reject. That shared culpability.
Inside the Department of Housing, we definitely have requests for additional staff to help with some of the
oversight. And I'm fine with that. I would be finer with strategic placement of auditors than just we get a bad audit and we're going to smear 14
auditors.
And
I'm not, Senator, don't get me wrong, I'm not talking about auditors. I'm talking about the other administrative staff
to
provide
the
oversight of these core programs. When we talked with Director Salazar, that was one of the most critical pieces. We knew there was going to be an influx of more push to do more, but the infrastructure to manage that additional wasn't there.
And I'm happy to support.
And I'm not talking about internal.
I guess I would only add the importance of that if you're doing more deals with private sector entities
and nonprofits.
And
the nonprofits could be scary.
But nonprofits' lack of maybe sophistication and private sector entities maybe having an objective that's different than the state's objective fundamentally.
That will all be a fascinating new element.
I will.
In
I think so, too.
In the interest of time, if that's all right, I'd like to make sure Alice has a chance to talk to you about what something you asked about, which is deferred maintenance. So we talked about PAB, and this just the last few slides just summarizes the numbers that we talked about. So
let's invite Alice up, and before she does that, let's just make sure we'll do a little time check. So we're going to hear from Alice, as we asked before, around deferred maintenance and plans. And then the thought is that we're each individually going to share our edits and comments.
Yes.
We could do some of that in person if we need to. You're going to come back with an additional
if it's all right,
is that right?
With the commission,
yeah.
Just because you're also busy. I've got comments already from Representative Nathan, so if you have edits, I'm going to do a black line version.
Great.
And I can either send just those pages or the whole report and then do an email vote just so that we don't have to pull you back in, and unless you prefer to have a meeting where we do a vote.
That sounds fine. So let's just make sure that we're doing that correctly in terms of public meeting. We may need to do a call to make it. We'll figure that out after.
Would it be okay to do it by a call?
I'm fine to do it with an on-the-record call. I will admit, with the press of other business, I haven't looked at this.
Okay. Well, we'll be doing some edits, and then Lee and I will schedule an online call so we don't have to necessarily all be here in Salem in the next week or week and a half, if that's all right.
Well, I'll be here, so.
You can come down. You don't have to be on the phone. That's fine, too.
I'll be here, too.
My goal is for us to come to consensus, and then within the first week, the legislature's in session, we can distribute our report.
Yes.
Very good.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks for coming back, Alice.
You bet. So I am here to talk to you today about our capital program, and specifically around the issues of deferred maintenance and capital renewal. So what our office does is we work with agencies on their long-range capital plans. We assess the facilities. We have an understanding portfolio-wide of what our needs are. We also work on their seismic needs and their modernization plans, so all of that. But today what we're really focused on is the deferred maintenance and capital renewal. So. In total, the state has almost 40 million square feet of real estate, including the legislature, the judiciary, and the universities.
And those are square feet that are owned by the state, not
owned by the state. Exactly, owned by the state.
And do you also have the inventory yet of what we lease?
We do have the inventory of what we lease.
It was very frustrating to me.
Actually, I should say the state agencies have the inventory of what we lease. With respect to the universities, is that what you're asking?
No.
No.
And let me just finish my thought here.
Please.
When I was first elected, I asked what I thought was a simple question to ask. I said, I'd like to see the full list of everything the state is using. Well, there isn't such a thing. I said, well, do you have the list of what we own? Well, no, not really. You can ask each agency. Well, I was appalled at that situation, and I'm still appalled then if what I have to do is ask each entity and each agency, what are you leasing? Because if we're going to do a good analysis of should we purchase a building instead of dropping money on monthly and yearly rent or leases, why are we doing a five-year lease when maybe we should have done a two-year because now we can have this agency consolidate and share that's enough on that right
her.
Now, but something isn't right with this.
You have it for leases as well as the...
For the state agency side.
For the state agency.
Alice is saying is we don't have it for the university.
We don't have it for the university.
Well,
why not?
Well, I've been talking to Heck about that problem.
The reason is that the Heck is not the state agency. They're not under our purview.
Yeah.
Okay, I reject that answer. They are an instrumentality of getting us information, and if the Prisley universities don't want to cough up what lease space they have, we need to compel them. What's the problem, George? How come we can't get this list from the state, from the university?
So I think
they
that's
do
a conversation
ask us for
with
money
the
from time to time.
I think you could adjust state law to get that.
personally.
Okay, so we do not have any information from the universities about lease space.
I do not have any information.
Let me ask this more broadly.
Sure.
Do we have information anywhere?
We, the chief financial office, do not have information on their leases. That's not, they're not under our purview. They're not under our control.
Okay.
We do have with the state agency side. We know what they own because of the work that's been happening with us. We know what we lease. We know those kind of things. But they're a separate entity from us. We passed law that moved them out. They really, we're actually a bit player in their larger funding stream. They're fairly...
Not by their choice, believe me. I'd like to just stake out a point with LFO that when we start talking about funding higher ed, I want that list.
Yeah, and I think HEC has run into a lot of... They're in an awkward position in some ways where they're kind of the intermediary between everyone who wants information from the universities and the universities who don't necessarily want to give it freely.
Correct.
But you do ultimately have the decision... how much state support those universities are going to provide. And if there are things you want HEC to track about universities, let us, you know, we need to make that clear now, because otherwise HEC has no teeth to get it out.
I'm going to go back into our next meeting and at least lay that down. So.
And it does, I think this conversation does potentially flow into what is mentioned in the report around deferred maintenance, because deferred maintenance is an issue not only in
yeah.
state buildings, but mm-hmm. in university buildings. So,
okay.
go ahead.
Yeah.
But to go back to the original comment, when you first came on, we probably couldn't even answer the question for the state.
Right. Yeah, you
we've
could.
Made a tremendous amount of progress, because we actually have a pretty solid idea of all of the phases where we actually, and we actually have conversations now about here are the leases that are coming due in a particular region.
Good.
Does it make sense to actually
call thank you. And that's my point.
There are a lot of other considerations in that. Local communities would rather lease than have the state just buy a piece of property for lots of local tax property reasons and other things.
Mm-hmm.
But we absolutely do look at that at this point.
Well, one other area that just because we own something and it needs deferred maintenance doesn't mean we should be maintaining that. If we're leasing a bunch of space, maybe what we need to do is ditch that property and acquire something else and consolidate. I would like assurance that we're making rather comprehensive, holistic decisions instead of just one-off, oh, here's a building and it really is in bad shape. We're going to fix it up. And then we're three other properties that we were leasing and we never even thought about how that factors in to a deferred maintenance decision.
I would join in supporting your comments, but also the question of, is the right default always to fix an old dog building,
mm-hmm.
or do you abandon an old dog building at some point?
Yeah.
And the other question is that of the buildings that we are leasing, and I don't know what I'm talking about in detail other than a very cranky constituent, is that this is a building that has housed a DHS facility. He's done renewals in the past, comes up for renewal this time, and is dealing with some Chicago outfit that cost him $146,000 to renew his lease with DAS. And my curiosity is, are we subbing out rent negotiations to someone else? Are they from out of state? Why aren't we doing it ourselves? What's the cost-benefit ratio of a guy that wants to do business with the state? It costs him $146,000 to renew a lease.
So, Senator, it sounds like a terrible story. I don't want to give a short shrift to that, but I also want to make sure we get through the question here about deferred maintenance versus new stuff. So.
A lovely written answer would suffice.
And if I could take just one small side step. 10 years ago, we would never have these kind of conversations. When Alice and her team have done a number of work, just a microcosm, the Department of Aviation came in this time and asked for $200,000 to fix up roof on one of their buildings out here.
The building's a dog.
So the conversation, driven by Alice and the Alice has happened, was first saying they can never, Alice telling us, they cannot replace that roof for $200,000. There's no way they can do that. That number's a low ball, so you need to say no. Second conversation, is that building the terrible building?
I worked in that building for 5 years. It's a dog. They don't scrape it.
To go back to the representative, your comment, 10 years ago, we never had those conversations. Now that Alice has come on board, we've done this analysis, we are much more having a dialogue about what should we do. Our decision in the governor's budget with aviation was rather, let's set aside some money for them, let's set aside the $100,000 or $200,000 to a side account, let them come back with a real plan about what their real plan looks like, how it meets their long-term deferred maintenance, and then have a dialogue with the legislature as to what we should do.
All right.
So we have changed that.
Okay.
Let's get
thank
back
you
up a little yep altitude here. Is that
thank
okay
you very much. I appreciate
please
that.
Great. Thank you. So the 20 agencies that own real estate, 4,600 buildings, 23.3 million gross square feet, valued at over $7 billion. 700 of those are major facilities that are valued at $1 million and over, and that represents 90% of the current replacement value of our portfolio. The other 3,600, or 3,900 rather, are small facilities, and they can be things like, you know, pit toilets and yurts and all different kinds of things, and they are sprinkled all over the state, and many of them are facilities that the Natural Resource Agency, you know, understandably. So those are, you know, they represent a big portion of our portfolio, but not much value. So to date, we've completed 70% of our portfolio of the 10 largest agencies. There's, let's see, the remaining 10 agencies have self-reported their needs. We still have to do facility condition assessments of those, and I should talk a little bit about what that process is. And four, and about 17% or 4 million square feet, we will not centrally assess because they're too small, they're too far-flung, and it really makes more sense for the agencies themselves to assess them. We have a tool to do that, which standardizes costs and methodology and teach them how to use it so that they can best do it on their own. And ODOT actually has been doing this for years, and they've begun using our tool over the last 2 years.
Does that $4 million also, does that suggest that that's also of relatively limited financial value too?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Are you spot checking at all the agency self-reporting?
We have a few, but not many.
And in the few that you've checked, is it a high level of accuracy?
It's pretty good.
Okay.
And it's because they're using the standardized tool that
yes
you're providing?
That's correct.
I had
it's made a huge difference.
I was at a Fish and Wildlife one to see the tool for a meeting last
yeah
session, and, you know, you fill in the form, and there's a certain way you fill in the form, and so once they're trained, it looked to me that it was something you could pick an iPad out in the field and just
and
do.
And now it is an iPad.
Yeah.
Take the pictures, it's all... we'll show it to you in a bit, but it's pretty well done. So this is a program that we started in 2014, and the legislature funded. We hired Faithful and Gould, who are national and actually international experts in facility assessments, cost estimation, and construction management. The architect of the Capitol used them. The state of Utah uses them. They've done a fantastic job for us, and they ground truth the status of our facilities. So the size of them, the condition, the age, they walk through every square foot and they make notations and barcode equipment to identify really what is the status of our facilities by element, and it all goes into a database that we can actually manage. So we, it doesn't capture everything because they don't do any destructive testing. You know, for example, OLCC's roof, we couldn't see the condition of the structure below it because there was no evidence of it. But, you know, so it may capture, we'd say, on average about 80% of the need, not 100. But it's as good as you can get in, you know, for reasonable planning. So
do we own the tool?
We have a software agreement for the tool. So
software as a service?
Software as a service. And the data is on the cloud as well as now and at the state. So we have it.
We own the data.
We own the data, and we have We now have the interoperability between the databases, and that actually took a long time to happen, but it's working now, so we're pretty happy about that. So the data, the metric that we use to measure how good or poor a facility is called a facility condition index. So it's the ratio of the need over the current replacement value of the facility. And this is an industry metric. So our goal is to be at 5%, not zero. So not perfect, so that makes no sense from a planning.
Make sure I understand that ratio. 5% being the target, meaning it would cost 5% more to replace what you have than its current value? Or
it means that there's 5% of work needed on a building.
5%?
Get it up to perfect. No.
No.
Perfect is zero over.
A brand new building.
A brand new building.
Go ahead.
But over your portfolio, you don't want perfect. That actually is not good planning. What you want is good.
But the 5% then is the gap from what it would cost to get to zero, not that you'd want
correct.
To. But,
correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So actually the other way I would say it is that if you have a building worth $1 million, and you have $500,000 of deferred maintenance on that building, you get a ratio of 50%.
Yeah,
that's going to show up as poor.
Yeah.
And you need to have a conversation about, should I shut this building down?
Yeah.
Okay. If you have only $100,000 on a $1 million building, that's going to push into the good category.
Then you're
and
making me feel better.
Like getting at which,
yeah, it's kind
which
of what
it's
yeah.
It's kind of getting at what you both said, mm-hmm. which was, why are we putting good money after bad?
Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in the industry, when you begin to approach 60% of need of work over the value, that is when you look at replacement facility. Then it's clear that this is no longer makes sense. And by having a 10-year planning horizon, you're not looking at one individual year, but you're looking at the accumulated need over time, then you really can make much better judgment per building. And we have this level of information by building.
So can we make specific reference to this sort of stuff in
the
report?
We can take a snapshot and add it to our capital
mm-hmm.
needs. We've talked about adding that
okay,
in.
Okay, good.
So there are key part with the facility condition that is also projecting out this HVAC system in this building needs to be replaced 5 years from now.
Yeah.
So that you can
right.
really start
mm-hmm.
planning forward what's it going to
right.
look like.
So that is the difference between deferred maintenance
yeah.
and capital renewal. So deferred maintenance is work that you didn't do when you needed to do it. Capital renewal is planned replacement. So a system, a HVAC system is supposed to last 35 years. In year 35, you should plan to replace it. You don't always, and sometimes they last much longer, but sometimes they're shorter. It's that kind of vagary. But this is, you know, your planning horizon that you begin to make sure to take care of these things when we do. So by agency, this is the 10 agencies who have had FCA, and you can see that the 2018 condition for the agency of all the facilities that were evaluated, it goes from good to poor. But, you know, DAS is at 4.2 on the higher end. At DPSST, it has practically moved campus, so it's only at 1%. But if over 10 years there is no additional investment in any of these, all of these agencies will fit into the core category. So the
and then what does the so the 2028 when I'm looking out there is that what is the assumption that gets you to that
no additional maintenance.
That's what it would
so,
be okay.
So this is the cumulative need if there is no additional investment.
Okay.
Fortunately, there's SB 1067. So. The information is organized in all different kinds of ways, but the way that we look at it is by priority. So priority 1 through 3, and it aligns with our budget instructions, is by urgency. How immediate and how critical is it? When does it need to be done? Priority 4 is seismic and hazard, natural hazard remediation, and for us, it's almost all seismic. So as part of the facility condition assessment, we've done rapid visual screens on all facilities that are valued at over $1 million. And then we take that information, we work with the DOGAMI, and we developed a benefit cost analysis tool to figure out which seismic work we actually really should do and have prioritized it, because there's honestly not enough money to do everything, but we really need to figure out what are the critical things we need to do. And that seismic information coupled with the deferred maintenance information and, you know, the modernization needs, that really develops the long-term capital plan for agencies. So they need all of these pieces in order to really understand what it is that we should do.
On the project priority rating, this is just about the physical structure, I assume, and doesn't at this point factor in what kind of program is it? Is the public coming in and out every day, or is it just agency staff?
Good question.
Actually, we do that for seismic analysis. That, you know, the population of a building is critical in evaluating, you know, benefit cost analysis for seismic. In terms of the criticality, the functionality, I think is really what you're referring to. That is factored in as well. But most of this, in terms of condition and deferred maintenance, looks at truly the condition and of the systems and whether they're at failure, that sort of thing.
So that's a really interesting point, Representative, because it would suggest that priority four is not necessarily four in terms of importance, but that it's kind of just a separate thing.
Right.
Not the sequence here, but different category.
Exactly. So for FCI to look at the condition of a building, the industry really only looks, doesn't look at seismic, because that's kind of, that's unique to Oregon and Pacific Northwest. And functionality varies a lot depending upon the program and its delivery. So I think all of these are factors in what we look at. You know, whether a building can be upgraded to make it more functional or whether it's really truly reached functional obsolescence. So those are all things that are factored into the plan. But for the slides that you're going to see, we really have focused on deferred maintenance and capital renewal. This slide shows really all the priorities that are in the software right now. So it's priority 1, 2, and 3, current. So that is the agencies that have been assessed, the number without the asterisk, that's that number. So $456 million in 2018. And then the next number over is our extrapolation of what it would be over the rest of the portfolio, just to give ourselves a sense of, you know, what the outside might be. But again, we don't have that data to really show it, but I think for us not to address it, would it be...
Does this include or not include higher ed?
It does not include higher
okay.
ed. This is just the agency. And then the same number in 2018, and what you see basically is that it more than doubles. Or 2028, I'm sorry, if we don't, invest.
Okay.
Right? So here, this really only looks at two things, the capital renewal and deferred maintenance. But by far, the biggest need in our portfolio is deferred maintenance. And of course, deferred maintenance is almost all in the current year.
So I want to make sure I understand the relationship between this
sure.
slide and the previous one. Capital renewal, I think I understand. Deferred maintenance, is that priority 1, 2, and 3? Is that how much of deferred maintenance is included in this description?
So it is 1, 2, and 3, but it is mostly in 1 and 2. There's
okay.
very little that's actually
some
in 3.
Of 3. All of 1, all of 2, and some of 3?
Well, it's not all of 1. I mean, it's pretty much all of 1, but not exclusively.
Most of all, most of 1, some of 2,
so,
a little 3.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I know that's muddy, but it's the truth.
Learn what ahead. Thank you.
So the blue line there is the annual funding using 2% of SB 1067.
2% of the value of replacement
value? The current replacement value.
Okay.
So that's about $70
million. But it doesn't get you deferred maintenance. You got to do something.
You got to do something.
You got to do some one-time boost to get to that.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think you can, but steady. I think this is the slide that shows you what you're able to achieve by that. So the yellow line is the cumulative cost for deferred maintenance and capital renewal. The blue line is the cumulative 2%. And you can see the net liability in 2025, the lines cross. And then we really start lowering the net liability of deferred maintenance and capital renewal.
And in essence, the net liability is the gap between the two?
Right.
Okay.
Exactly, the gap. So that's not to say that it addresses everything, but it's huge progress, which I think is total good news.
That's a real issue with physical assets. You can't take care of it all at once. You have to have a consistent approach to bring it down.
Yes.
Right. So I think that's what this really shows. It does not address the issue of the seismic work, which is substantial, or functionality. But one thing that we know is that the state government on the whole is not really growing its footprint, you know, at a very, very modest level. And on the whole, we're trying to consolidate. So that is a good thing that we're managing to keep that.
Senator Johnson and I were on a cost containment work group, and one of the things we talked about was staffing, state employees per capita. Do we have some sort of a figure that we could look at about state facilities, square feet, or something? Because from what I saw, even before the cost containment work group, state government was not, some people were saying, oh, it's out of control the way it's growing. And it really wasn't. It might have even been reduced per capita over a period of years. And I'm wondering if you can demonstrate the same thing with
Phil. Would that be just your state employees divided by population? Is that all you're asking for?
Well, we have that as facilities.
Oh. Okay.
You know, if people say, oh, you're just building all these buildings.
Hydro halls.
Or replacing buildings, I think. I think the hard part is we don't have the historical, the square feet, how many years back to 14?
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, comparison
well
to
that's
other
okay.
States,
actually, we did that analysis, and certainly do that.
Could you just show me something? You
maybe
know,
we can have a little graph that just shows what you thought the square footage was each of these
yeah,
years that we
not did. Urgent, but it's something I might want to be able to talk about.
Sure. So the square foot of
what you your
analysis,
snapshot was each
yeah.
fiscal year or something, the last year.
Just
I think we have that, actually. Or, you know, we have the best that we have of it.
Yeah,
I think we have something to share, for sure.
A different question. I thought I heard you say this slide has zero seismic in it. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
And when you talk about seismic, I forget the terminology, but there's the building won't collapse on you. You can get out of it, and then there's and you can go back in and actually use it.
So
which are you?
That's a really good question. There's different levels of performance. The code minimum is called life safety, meaning that you can evacuate the building. And then there's a performance level above that, which is damage control. And then above that is immediate occupancy. So there, depending upon, frankly, the function of the building, the age of the building, the cost to repair, we will do different things.
Okay.
For new buildings, we think that it makes much more sense for the state to build above code. For all of our facilities, the cost, the incremental cost, is not that significant, and it just is wise.
Above code, or what I'm going to call show-off buildings.
we had two show-off buildings that come quickly to mind. One of them was the cross-laminated timber in Portland that had a projected cost of $650 a square foot. I don't think that building was ever built. And there's been conversation about the yellow building, the yellow parking lot building. And I don't know whether above code and show-off buildings, what's the delta?
I don't think they're the same.
They're not the same.
I know they're not the same, but when you say above code, what I'm trying to figure out is with a paucity of funds, what moderates our enthusiasm for building these goofy buildings that are system show-off buildings?
Part of it's going to depend on how quickly the state needs it operational and how critical it is, right?
Because the real issue is that as we talk about our buildings, we don't need to build all of them, and we certainly can't afford to retrofit all of our buildings to be immediate occupancy. But the real question has been, we don't have any that are immediate occupancy, and should we have one or two?
Well,
that can be
for those who have continued to function in government,
that's the question.
After the big event.
That's the question.
That's where it's...
But I was going to say, I think the cross-laminate building was done by the Home Forward, because we gave them PAD that they never financed. They didn't build that. So that was fortunately not a state building. That makes you feel any better.
But the money wasn't expended.
The bonds were never issued because the cost got crazy.
Yeah.
Anyway, for DAS, for example, we actually went through all of our buildings and evaluated, 10 that really are our priority to repair. And on the whole, most of them are going to be repaired at life safety or slightly above. They're not going to be at immediate occupancy because we can't, cost effectively achieve it. So
part of our Kenya plan is we have to get all of our buildings up to at least life safety, because we're exposed right now. A number of buildings on certain university systems as well, they're highly prone to not be able to be there after the big shaking.
Does that contemplate something beyond the big shaking? I'm thinking radon, mold, asbestos. I mean, some asbestos, I guess, in situ is okay, but if you mess with it, you...
Right. So all of that is part of the evaluation of buildings. You look at, all of the hazard mitigation, whether it's natural hazards, and really for us, really just seismic, or the hazard material. That's all part of the work.
And I can't say some of the higher ed things we've done, like in Portland State, they're just replacing those horrible buildings with newer buildings.
Yes.
Right.
So it's not like they're expanding their footprint necessarily, but they have, because Alice used to work with them, they've been trying to get out of those buildings where they can. I know the U of O administration building finally, isn't that one of the old building finally being addressed?
I don't actually know which
Campbell?
One.
Campbell, yeah.
So,
I think that's the value of these cost-benefit analysis tools, that you look at the mission functionality, you look at the cost of doing the work, the value of the building, to see, and what is the risk in terms of how frequently the building is used, if it's 24/7 or if it's only really 10 hours a day. All of those things are factored into our evaluation of does this make sense or not. And the ones that have the highest benefit-cost analysis, those are the ones that we do. The ones that are, just at one or one and a half, probably not. Or not now.
This is enormously helpful, at least to me. I think it's the right thing for us to be talking about in this report, as the legislature will decide how to allocate this capacity. And you started it, Justin, thinking about this. Thank you for doing
this. So this is just a dashboard of the interface. These are some screenshots of the program. You can't read any of it, but just to show. We have all this great stuff. And this is actually the iPad app. So you walk around, you take photographs, you can look up in real time all of the systems, all of the systems.
Is there a question, are you using buckets to collect water?
Well, like I said, I've heard about Fish and Wildlife and about all of these old troughs that the fish are in that are, we're trying to save salmon, and there's an earthquake, and all the salmon are going to... So that was...
Quickly.
They were really... struck home with me about the pipes and everything.
Yeah.
They're all Fish and Wildlife.
Right.
So the fact that they can go out and do it.
Stolen before the crushing comes.
Yeah.
great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So if it's okay
yeah.
with the commission, what I'd ask
yeah.
is continue sending us comments for the end of the week. Let's just say Monday. I have rating agency calls Monday and Tuesday, so I'll be kind of busy. I'll start working on the report early, mid-next week, send out my black line, and then I will try and set up a call. It'll probably be after the legislature comes back into session early in that week, I believe the week of, right after MLK.
That all makes sense. I do want to reserve at least 90 seconds or something if anyone wants to make any generic comments that would accompany their...
Which I can incorporate.
Yeah, and I would say for myself, I really want, as Lauren and I have talked, to go even a little further than she already did in this draft in highlighting the deferred maintenance and seismic question, and
mm-hmm.
we talked about some ways to do that. But
okay, I have one.
Yeah, please.
I brought this up in my first meeting, and I have not read the report, so I can't comment whether or not you comment on it. But I have brought a summary of the significant court orders in the Linn County case. And I've got one for DAS as well. I was really surprised at the first meeting how little recognition there was of this pending case. It's now been set for trial on October the 24th. It is a it's more than $1 billion. It's $1.5 billion. And I don't know what effect this has on our bond ratings and whether or not the markets know about it, and we're disclosing this as a material fact. This one's for you, George, for risk management. This is just a summary. You have it?
They are very much aware of this issue. Yep.
Okay, well, this is just...
But I would like a copy of it.
This is just a summary of the order. As I understand it, the state has filed 16 motions. We have lost on all of them but one, and that was for prejudgment interest. But I think that this is a very significant issue for the state, and I'm quite concerned that there is not wider spread concern about it. So that one is for DAS.
For the record, we do disclose in all of our official statements about the court case. As far as in this report, to best address it rather than the specifics of this case, I think a category that we need to preserve debt capacity for may be legal judgments in general, because I think maybe that would be a more generic way of talking about debt capacity for very large settlements that we couldn't come out of pocket for in a different way. Having said that, we don't have a constitutional carve-out, so it would have to be appropriation debt if we did it. So I think let me take a crack at writing a paragraph like that.
I would. That was that. We don't have to talk about the specifics of this case.
I think
it's something that acknowledges the clear and present danger of either a massive settlement or loss of trial.
And I think we can have paragraph. But we do always address any litigation that could cost us more than $200 million. It has to be disclosed to investors. So
it's $1.2 billion.
I understand. Yeah. We have others in there too.
Clearly above the threshold.
Yeah.
Thank you for raising that. Any other general comments? Okay. Representative?
Thank you. There are 90 legislators and a governor who advocate for all sorts of interesting and wonderful and often necessary individual projects that we borrow money to pay for. It's not often that someone advocates for all this kind of stuff. Deferred maintenance is a biggie. There are other aspects of the business of government, our infrastructure, that who's watching out for it? We're using bonding now to pay for major IT systems, and it's probably a fine and appropriate thing. But that's another area where, because we didn't replace mainframe systems on a sort of a schedule, like you should be taking care of buildings on a schedule, because we didn't do that, that we have some terrible potential security problems, but it's going to cost a bundle to kludge together the security solutions when we should just be replacing a system, for example. I don't know how it gets expressed in a report like this, but if there were a way to make a statement from this commission, if we agree, that someone's got to be looking out for the underpinnings, the infrastructure of what keeps government working, because it just doesn't come up usually in the normal business during a legislative session. Everyone's too busy advocating for the neat, cool project that needs to be done, not this level of stuff. The other thing I hope comes out somewhere, this is pretty technical stuff. What is the purpose of our bonded indebtedness? It's to make sure we're getting maximum value for Oregonians. It's to make sure we're protecting our bond rating, to make sure we're helping stretch our dollars as far as possible. I hope somewhere there's language that says what is the outcome we're looking for here by doing this very careful work.
Thank you.
I would agree.
That's Dewey?
I'm good.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
I had plenty of time to speak.
Yeah, okay. Good. Anything else we need to cover?
No, I will be contacting all of you for, as I said, I'll try and get something out next week after I get your feedback, edits, I'll add, and then we'll shoot for right after MLK Day just a call to kind of go over those black lines. Director can be on great, otherwise we'll reach you.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, I think
it's the county pursuing the stage over
and
forth.
Yeah.
It's that one. And so, like, we.
Okay. We're sorry. Your conference is ending now. Please hang up.